Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders focusing on sustainable and impact investment and performance with purpose, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness in the market and highlight best practices in order to help more companies and institutions transition more capital into the industry faster. I'm JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners. I am grateful that you're choosing to invest your time in doing this, since I know that you're going to feel encouraged and inspired. Make sure you subscribe to get the notifications from your preferred podcast platform. And do follow us on social media to stay connected. We appreciate your support. It helps keep Impact Leaders going. Enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. I hope you're well, safe, and healthy. On today's episode, we are doing something different. We are sharing with you a session that I called the Sustainable Investment Dilemma, a conversation I hosted as part of the COG Extra weekly event series, covering in this opportunity the subject of sustainable business, how industry is addressing the climate crisis. In our case, the financial industry. As my co-panelist today, I bring together two guests, Amy Clark, who is co-founder and chief impact officer of Tribe Impact Capital, and Troy Mortimer, who is a responsible investment and sustainability expert and responsible investment and ESG advisor at ILM Partners. If you do not know them already, I highly recommend that you also listen to the individuals' episodes we recorded previously. As part of the event, I also share a short video introduction to the recently launched film Our Planet, Too Big to Fail, which is a 42-minute film that explores the risks of inaction, the impact of investing as usual, and the role the finance sector can play powering a sustainable future. I wanted to bring this to your attention to ask you to watch it and share it so we can all take proactive actions. I also thought this is relevant to set the tone ahead of our conversation. But most importantly, I wanted to shine the light on one of the best tools we have to create awareness and understand how interconnected the industry is to every part of society and the world at large. Please note that we had a couple of technical challenges that were all resolved during the first few minutes of this episode, but I wanted to make sure you had access to this valuable content. So we start this episode picking up at the beginning of the conversation with the respective introductions from Amy and Troy themselves. Enjoy.
We apologize to everybody watching. JP is in deepest, darkest rural Kent, and it would appear today as if the Wi-Fi down there is not playing ball with him. Just on that film, if anyone hasn't seen it, if you go to ourplanet.com, I think it is, it's the Netflix series of Our Planet, you can see the live stream version of it on there. It's really worth watching. It's a very, very powerful clarion call, really, to global finance to step up and lean in more. There are a lot of Troy's and mine's and our collective friends on there with some great kind of words of wisdom and insights. So definitely do get 42 minutes, I think it is in total, 42 minutes one evening to sit down and watch it. But Troy, do you want to introduce yourself to everybody so we all know who you are and where you come from?
Sure. Great. So good afternoon, everyone. My name is Troy Mortimer. I've worked in sustainability and responsible investment for a number of years. Up until April of this year, I was heading KPMG UK's sustainability and responsible investment practice as part of a 20-year career at KPMG across multiple continents and countries. Prior to the UK, I was down in Panama, and previous to that, I was heading an NGO, the for-profit side of a Canadian NGO based in Latin America, doing impact-related projects. So I'm very excited about today. I'm going to give you some perspectives on what I'm seeing at the institutional level and how we can really push this forward. Amy.
Brilliant. Thanks, Troy. And there are a few people I can see in the attendees list who I know. So hi, it's lovely to see you on this. So I'm Amy Clark. I'm the co-founder and the co-founder of Tribe Impact Capital, which is a big corporation and a dedicated impact wealth manager. So 100% of the assets that we have under management are managed for additional and material alignment and delivery of the Sustainable Development Goals and the Paris Climate Accord. We're based in London, but obviously we have a global view as an investment house. And I was just saying to Troy earlier, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I have been working in this space for over a quarter of a century, having trained as a climate and a soil scientist at uni and then focusing at postgrad on environmental policy and law. I came straight out into working in sustainability. So roughly speaking, about 9 years as a management consultant, actually not with KPMG, with PwC and EY. Sorry, Troy. But working specifically on sustainability through the lens of global financial services, which was an incredibly interesting and sort of seminal part in many ways of my career. I then decided to move in-house, so became the sustainability lead for Microsoft in the UK, the part of a sort of a threesome who were hired into Microsoft in the very, very early days, one in the US, one in Paris, and one in London. That was me. And then was asked to go and join what was Bank of America and that what then became Bank of America Merrill Lynch. So I've sort of been sort of steeped in many ways in that corporate sustainability agenda, but became increasingly frustrated and I think very acutely aware of the fact that it's our relationship with money, our relationship with our wealth, that is trumping our relationship with each other and our relationship with nature. So if we can create a much healthier relationship with our wealth and the purpose of our wealth, then actually we should be able to fix, repair, increase the resilience and ultimately regenerate the relationships we have with each other and with nature, which is why then Tribe, Impact Capital, we're known as the Tribe, which is why then Tribe came into my sort of consciousness and the rest, as they say, is history. So hopefully, Troy and I think JP might have just joined, but if not, Troy and I are going to have a fantastic conversation.
Yeah, I've rejoined. No more videos from me.
Fantastic. Well, we've introduced ourselves, JP. So back to you.
That's great. That's the way to do it, right? Just pass it on to the guests to do the work. Okay. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining once again. I won't attempt to engage with video anymore so we can keep the conversation going. I would like to start by stating something that may be obvious, which is the reason why I picked the main title for this session to be the Sustainable Investment Dilemma. As you may also have seen in the past months, there is another fascinating documentary that was released earlier this year called The Social Dilemma. And I think there are many comparisons we could make in terms of what we have created initially, thinking that it was for a good reason, and the negative versus the negative effect that it's actually causing. And in many ways, links both the world of technology, which brings us together today as a force for good, and the last comment in the introduction video that you didn't get to see by Mark Carney, former governor of the Bank of England, where he says that the financial sector is an enormously powerful and effective force, and it can be a force for good. So on that note, my first question that I wanted to raise with you was, let's start with the dilemma. So can the financial sector be a force for good? What is required for this to happen? Maybe, Amy, would you like to start?
I'm very happy to. I mean, I think the answer to that question is very obviously and very honestly, yes. You have to remember when we talk about the global finance system is nothing but the collection of the people who work in it. It responds to the stimulus, and the stimulus is human. It's our beliefs and our values. And the Sunday before, it was the 50th anniversary of Milton Friedman's seminal essay that was penned and then printed in the New York Times magazine, 13th of September, 1970. And we have to sort of look at that and say, well, at the time, that essay, that work was very much imbued and infused by the values and the belief systems that were in play then. We have to look at those values and belief systems and say, are they fit for future? Are they fit for now? And are they fit for future? And I think it's clear to see from the growing call for building back better, for global resets, that there is a real sense that the values and the belief systems upon which we have built this global finance system aren't right. They're not fit. They're not robust. So I'm a huge believer in the fact that, you know, global finance can and should be a force for good. The same way I believe that businesses can and should be a force for good. You only have to look at the rise of the B Corp movement, which actually has the level of inward traffic in terms of, you know, BLAB assessments, but also then the use of the BLAB tool during lockdown has risen exponentially. So there's this real sense, I think, and shift. I think we're in 2020 is an inflection point. But what we have to ultimately do is to challenge the values and the belief systems upon which finance has been built. And this is where the role of impact investing and impact-driven investing really helps us, because what it's doing is two things. One, it's tackling the investment thesis at large. It's understanding the true nature of risk and the true nature of opportunity, recognizing what we now know. But also what it's doing is it's helping people, wealth holders, whether they're individuals or institutional wealth holders, it's really helping them reconnect with the purpose of their wealth. And when you consider that the word wealth comes from two Old English, 13th century Old English words meaning well-being, we've lost the well-being in wealth along the way, and it's become singularly focused on financial performance. You know, we've externalized the very things that actually create good, sustainable, long-term financial performance. So it does feel like we're at an inflection point. I think the answer to your question, JP, is absolutely yes. Can it be done? Absolutely yes. What needs to happen? We as individuals within the system, within businesses, and more broadly as consumers and global citizens, need to fundamentally interrogate our values and our belief systems and then vote. And we vote every day with what we buy, what we wear, what we eat, how we travel. That is how we create the change.
Excellent. Troy?
There always has to be someone who goes on mute and starts to talk. I'm just saying that 100% agree with that. This I see as a behavioral inertia problem, or challenge rather, or as that we have to overcome. And, you know, when you look at the behaviors of financial institutions that are absolutely comprised of individuals, you know, we have to look at what incentivizes that particular behavior. How are we rewarding people? How are we recognizing them? Yes. How are we associating value with their actions? And I think one of those challenges for really shifting the question of financial sector being a force for good is getting that into the way in which people are recognized, people, but also those companies. So this is where it comes down to the public of recognizing the reputation of those companies as being one that are either having a contribution to what we're deeming as value versus those that are merely putting a figure in our bank account or other statement that means something, but it doesn't necessarily mean greater purchasing power at the expense of lesser well-being. 2020, like, it's obvious, it's been said so many times, and we're going through this cataclysmic change right now, which, despite the million deaths that have happened around the world, I think we've needed socially a wake up to say, how are we doing things? How are we really valuing ourselves, our own time, what our company does? And, you know, time will tell whether we revert back to the old way of doing things because of this inertia, or whether have the flexibility to actually deviate from that. And that's where I think regulation, government, and corporates have a key role to play.
Yes. And on that, so I would say exactly that point. I think it's about how all the stakeholders, you know, interact. You know, the more and more I talk to all the different parts, obviously, initially, the investment world, but as I learn and look at all the different parts, it's how everyone plays a role. It's not just for us to do something if the other parts don't do their part, right? And on that point, I was just going to share, as you know, I host my beloved podcast, Impact Leaders, where you both have been honorable guests. And I just wanted to proudly share that I'm about to publish the latest episode, which is an interview with Mr. Saken Sebi, CEO of Federated Hermes International. And the reason why I mentioned that is because when we were talking about climate change and carbon investments, he shared that to solve the problem, we need three things to happen. Convince the company to close down or change business models. Secondly, find alternative sources of what the company does. And thirdly, convince consumers to shift consumer behavior. So if we take these points, you know, into consideration, and please, you know, share with you if you agree or disagree, what steps do you think that, or can financial services businesses adopt to become more sustainable and to help through this, let's say, supply chain of the parts?
Yeah, there are huge things. I mean, Saka always speaks, you know, a lot of sense in this space. You know, he and I have had some phenomenal conversations about this. I think, you know, we have a duty of care as a system, a finance system, to transition those companies who are truly, authentically, and with high levels of integrity, wanting to transition their businesses to becoming future fit, to becoming real delivery agents of the future that we then need. We have a duty of care to the shareholders more broadly and the universal owners, so those who may hold those companies in pension funds, but also we have an opportunity as well to transition these companies. And that's where you start to look at, okay, the different types of asset classes, the different financial vehicles that are out there in the marketplace to do that. So I agree with what Zach is saying. I think what we need to do is to stimulate and encourage the finance system to recognize that we can transition, not all necessarily, but, you know, we can transition a lot of these companies through to becoming forces for positive change and forces for good. You know, you look at, okay, you look at what was Danish Oil and Natural Gas and is now Ørsted. Now, okay, they weren't listed until 2016, so they were government owned. But for them to pivot their entire business in a relatively short period of time from a predominantly black energy company to a predominantly green energy company, and then post IPO to be crowdsourcing in, you know, these impact investors and sustainable investors, because we can all see that they're setting a precedent. You know, it does set the template in many ways for other companies to follow. But we have to recognize the limitations of, for example, equity versus possibly the profound opportunities for debt, so fixed income instruments and debt in helping these companies transition. And this is the role of finance, is to be having these big conversations to say, okay, where we need to transition companies, what's the toolkit? What do we have? What do we maybe need to develop? How do we do it? How do we ensure that we safeguard the capital that's already invested? Because a lot of the capital in, you know, some of these businesses is your capital, JP, it's in your pension.
Yes.
You know, so how do we transition that responsibly? How do we also make sure that the people who work in these businesses have a future? They can see that they're still relevant in this new future. So that's where we talk about a just transition as well. And how can we do it quickly and effectively? And that is the role of finance as well as regulation and policy. You know, you need the stick and the carrot. I can see Troy's nodding a lot, so I'll let Troy come in now.
Yeah, thanks. That point around timing is really critical. And, you know, Mark Carney in the video you highlighted, JP, talks about how the later we leave it, the steeper the transition is going to be. And this is the whole point around sustainable investing, is trying to get a gradual transition for humanity to adapt to what's going to be this new world. And the longer we leave it, the more painful it's going to be, which is why it's important to kind of take action now. That the tricky thing about action in a meaningful scale is, I think we're still lacking in terms of broader terms around education at a societal level about what this all means. But we're probably preaching to the converted. It's the thousands that are out there saying, well, how do we make this? How do we distill this sort of behind the scenes so it's just happening? And I take it back to the UK auto enrollment of pension savings a few years ago, where this became the de facto approach. Previous to that, you had to be proactive. But we have to recognize that not everyone's, like, most people don't even understand what ESG means. You know, sustainability, also sort of foreign word. But this is where I think roles like regulation, capital requirements, and just broader measures that are going to gradually force the financial services industry to shift or realign their portfolios toward more sustainable investments is going to be critical. It's not something that, you know, consumers will continue to push as the David Attenboroughs and others come out there and the Netflix show these documentaries and start to ask questions. And that's fantastic. But the real meaningful flows of large amounts of capital are going to need to happen at the governmental level, at the interbank and central bank level, through a series of incentives. But also there needs to be some sticks. Like, I hate that that's the fact, but this is a behavioral thing. And sometimes you have to shift the behavior in order for people to make that shift. What I mean in practice is, I actually think we need to start pushing a greater percentage of portfolio content toward truly sustainable investments, where you're measuring not just the financial return, but also that broader impact. And you're getting a broader set of metrics out there, which are shared, transparent, and that we're a lot more open and accepting about measuring and commenting on both positive and negative impacts. But as investors, we also have a role to make sure that we're not immediately punishing those that are disclosing their negative impacts. Because what they're actually doing is they're being transparent and honest. Whereas the other guy that's sort of showing the fantastic returns with no impact probably is, if they're in the same industry, they're probably just not like hiding it. And what we should be doing is saying, we recognize that every industry has negative impact. Tell me about how you're transitioning through that. And if we can be more honest about that, then we can actually direct capital toward this transition in a more kind of structured manner.
And Troy, I was going to say, because it's really interesting you raise that, because it, you know, it is the whole spectrum of accounting practices. And then, you know, how do we move accounting practices on? Obviously, you and I have sat in large accountancy firms, and you do absorb, obviously, quite a lot when you're in that environment. And I think, you know,
For my sins, by the way, me, I started actually.
Well, exactly. So you think about the work, for example, that Harvard University are doing at the moment on impact-weighted accounts. and, you know, the annual cycle of annual reporting, and then saying, okay, well, actually, what is the true footprint of our business? And, you know, Puma piloted this years ago with their environmental cost accounting on P&L. Moved on, we've got the Principles for Carbon Accounting Finance as well, PCAF, which is really starting to drive down now as well. We had the announcement yesterday of the Big Four around, you know, the collaboration on ESG and then ESG disclosure in annual reports and accounting. I think some of the really interesting work that's going on here, though, is with the guys over at Rethinking Capital, who are looking at normative accounting and valuing mission and purpose as part of the equity line on an annual P&L, and saying, well, actually, if you get a better handle, for example, on what your true equity is as a business, and you factor in intangibles, which are always quite hard, and this is what they focus on, the guys over at Rethinking Capital, is the valuation of intangibles, you can actually create a space where the equity value of your business goes up if you are linking to mission and purpose, which means the costs associated with tackling the negative externalities are set in a better and more robust context, which means the shareholders effectively are able to come alongside and say, yes, we can understand what you're trying to do now, but we can actually ultimately understand how this is going to drive greater brand equity and therefore kind of, you know, greater dividends, greater cost per share. So we can understand that. And that's where I think, you know, alongside regulation and policy, accounting practices, you know, IFRS, GAAP, et cetera, you know, the TCFD is already using some of the accounting standards to drive the TCFD disclosure. It's really exciting. And, you know, to your point, you know, Troy, it does feel like there's a lot of planetary alignment starting to happen now. And again, you know, we shouldn't also, I think, underestimate the role of data and transparency, and the role of machine learning and artificial intelligence in helping individuals make better decisions, whether it's purchasing decisions or regulatory decisions, based on what the data is able to now tell us.
Yes, I was just going to say that at one point you mentioned Ørsted, and what I wanted to highlight is, you know, if you use cleaner green energy as an example, you know, understanding how long it actually takes and the complexity of a supply chain, for example, of that case, which is infrastructure, which is generating energy, which is one of the, you know, biggest polluters as well, is actually extremely complex and it takes a long, long time. That's just one success story out of not that many. And obviously, and I'll come back to this at the end as well, it's around how, you know, as financial services companies, investment managers, etc., how can they see, you know, the information that you mentioned, Amy, in terms of the intangibles, in terms of, you know, the what I call the net positive impact, you know, that the companies are having today and that they're trying to address, you know, going forward as they change the model, obviously using reporting and standards, you know, as you mentioned, Amy. Anything else that you would like to address in terms of the power of policies and regulation? Troy, you mentioned, you know, the carrot and stick, but then also we're having a private conversation yesterday and you mentioned that there are some delays now because of COVID in terms of, you know, potentially some of the big regulations are going to kick in. Anything that you can comment on that and maybe share in order to generate a bit of urgency?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. Basically, what I'm referring to is the fact that there's been some discussion within the asset management community about whether the EU sustainable finance regulations due to come in starting from March of next year should be postponed to allow greater time for asset managers to adapt to the new regulation. And part of their argument is that, you know, the EU itself hasn't given further detail on what that actually means in practice or the ability to actually comply with some of the metrics that they've already disclosed, that sort of additional detail is only going to be granted in January. Like, I think the tricky bit with this is if you keep pushing back deadlines, you ultimately are delaying a problem which is only going to have greater uncertainty and greater impact later on. And, you know, if we look at how AFMD and MiFID want to come in force, it's been a gradual process where, in my personal view, I think it's better that we hang on to those deadlines. We endeavor to actually meet that as much as possible, that you disclose to your regulator where you feel that you're actually still in that process of complying. And let's face it, things like GDPR, every company is still on that process of trying to work things out. So the delay of the regulatory deadline, in my view, is not the answer. It's about forcing companies to do that. Now, if you're sitting on the board, you're also weighing that off against the operational challenges of working through COVID. But actually, I think there's an opportunity here to say, what are we learning from COVID and how can we move that into this broader compliance? And ultimately, regulation will drive behavioral change, first in Europe. But if we are the sort of standard setters and the UK kind of gold plates that, there will eventually be the shift outward to, you know, global firms that might be operating in the US where their regulatory horizon is different, but because they're operating in EU markets, they will use to, will have to comply as well.
Yes.
JP, can I just add a couple of things, which are less about structural changes and more about the human, sort of the human changes as well. So there is a phenomenal podcast that I love listening to on a regular basis, obviously yours, JP. Outrage and Optimism, which is Cristiana Figueres, obviously the lady largely attributed, the success of the Paris Climate Accord is largely attributed to, she's a phenomenal lady, and Tom Rivett Carnac. And they interview really interesting, obviously, people in the public eye with regards to this sort of the climate crisis, but more broadly, the ecosystem crisis. And, I think it was earlier this week, or maybe it was last week. Anyway, they interviewed Bernard Looney. And JP knows this. I have a very, very cautious view on oil and gas. I used to do consultancy, sustainability consultancy with both BP and Shell, where BP on Lord John Brown's watch. And, you know, we've seen a whole range of duplicitous behaviors from global oil and gas companies over many, 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 many decades. So I am very, very cautious when it comes to oil and gas. We also, as an investment house, don't invest in oil and gas. We invest in clean tech and renewables because we are a solutions-based investment manager. But I have been listening with increasing interest since February when Bernard stepped up to the CEO plate, and he's leading differently. There's a different style of leadership that is required in this new world, a very different style of leadership that is required. It's an empathetic style of leadership. It is not trying to be right all the time. It is not trying to pretend that you know everything all the time. You know, we're moving away from this alpha sense of leadership to a much more, I would say, balanced, that, you know, much more male and feminine style of leadership, which is a more human style of leadership. And I was really struck by something that he said that his mother had told him. And I thought, this is a wonderful expression, absolutely wonderful. You know, Bernard is Irish. But his mother had said to him, you have two ears and one mouth. Use them in that ratio. Yeah. And I thought, that's perfect. That's absolutely perfect. We need to listen more. And we also need to listen to the people we disagree with. We need to be able to understand why we have a different point of view, you know, from theirs. What's driven that? And again, it comes back to values and beliefs. And where the common ground is and how we start to work together. And there is an increasing number of leaders coming through who are exercising those very basic behavioral principles. And this is what drives a huge amount of change as well, because it taps into that human desire to want to do the right thing far more than the old alpha style does. So I think, you know, leadership is massive, absolutely massive. And there's another great podcast that Solitaire Townsend did recently on sex status and sustainability. And obviously, as the only female, and JP, you know, I normally don't rock up as the only female on these types of things, but for you, I will. You know, it's really important that we tackle the issues around not just gender diversity, but diversity and inclusion more generally. The finance system needs to be a system that serves society and serves the planet, in which case it needs to be informed and representative of the people with the lived in experience to tackle these big issues. It needs to be representative of the society and the planet that we currently inhabit and the one that we need to be obviously focused in creating. So there is this massive push, as we know, in finance to get more women. And we're starting to see that come through. It's very, very early days at the moment, but more women in positions of influence. You know, the notorious RBG said that, you know, women need to be at every single table where decisions are being made. Are men? Yes, we absolutely do, but not just women. We need people of color. We need different sexual orientations. We need different cultures, different religions. We need everybody, a representation of everybody. And I think this plays to much more community and human-centered changes that are required in finance rather than obviously just sort of some of the big structural policy and regulatory changes, because those take time. Now, they can help drive and seed the conditions for this change to happen, but ultimately, I do come back to consumers, us as global citizens. Governments respond, businesses respond when we actively vote for what it is that we care about.
I'll just make two comments. I think one specifically to what you say in terms of caring and behaviors and the use AI. But then first, I just wanted to highlight. So I think that, you know, structurally, as you mentioned, in terms of regulation, let's say for risk management, you know, we have improved, you could say, many aspects, you know, including processes, you know, KYC, structure, balance sheet, tier one capital management, just to name but a few, mostly focus on the what, right? We also had that kind of to change, you know, in financial services and the way that we were behaving, especially after the financial crisis in 2008, which is kind of the how, you know, the how we behave in the industry. But it seems to me now that it's time to add this kind of new layer and call it angle perspective of regulation and reporting being key. But obviously, everything that you mentioned, Amy, in terms of looking at how, you know, we behave in terms of investing, you know, sustainably. Right? That's kind of one thought that I've been having that links back to everything that you guys were talking about. And then just, I want to also, just conscious of time, touch upon the point about AI and how, you know, AI can be used and data. So I have been, as you know, speaking, you know, with clients, with ILM partners and investors, you know, we are looking for as the right partners for ILA funds. And it seemed to keep coming across and individuals still focusing only on performance. I have come across a lot of people actually looking at distress situations more growingly, particularly given the current position that many companies have been forced into because of COVID. But the only ones or the most that I've seen are harnessing kind of AI is coming maybe from fintech companies and, you know, focusing on impact investment for millennials that I think, you know, Amy, you have invested in one and potentially microfinance, right? Mm-hmm. And the other side, one point I picked up early today at CogExtra from Steve Evans, the director of search at the Center for Industrial Sustainability, is that one of the hardest things to do is to change the way people think the world works, inverted commas. And this is a reflection I had recently, you know, in relation to this social dilemma documentary that I mentioned at the start, and linking to these 3 points that Mr. Nusebi mentioned, is this point about convincing people and convincing consumers especially to shift consumer behavior. And I think that perhaps that is where really AI can actually make a world of difference. But if we use the tools and the data we have to help people become aware, become conscious, and take action to change their behavior to consume only what is required, for example, to switch to alternative options, which as a consequence will force companies to change, and financial institutions to fund in new ways, you know. So I'm still on the van, on the wagon that we cannot put all the pressure just on financial services and investment managers and, let's say, pension funds. It is a cycle, and we all have, again, I insist, this part to play, obviously, you know, with a wrapper of, you know, policy and regulation, which I think is very important. I don't know if you want to make any comments. If not, I'm going to just ask you the last question just to start wrapping it up.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think the rise of not just fintech, the rise of technology as a mechanism through which, and data as a mechanism through which we can connect people with their impacts, their personal impacts, is huge. You know, we've seen, if we think about fintech, we've seen the rise of Ticker, for example, another B Corp family member of ours. We've got the rise of, you know, others like Climate who are coming through now as well. Think about consumer behavior. We're all consumers, you know, citizen behavior. You've got Kogo. They recently announced a massive partnership with NatWest. I can see Oliver's one of the attendees. You've got Almond as well. You know, you've got these incredible platforms where technology is helping us as global citizens and consumers to understand our footprint more, but also then to adjust the purchasing decisions that we're making, whatever it happens to be that we're purchasing. You've then got the rise of shareholder activism as well. So, for example, people like Tumelo, who are giving individuals the opportunity to actually understand what they're holding, for example, in their pensions or their ISAs, and then giving them the opportunity to kind of act on that as well. You know, we're seeing data and technology more broadly, you know, really being deployed now as a force for good, which is needed, because I don't know if you saw Antonio Guterres, you know, speech yesterday at Climate Week in New York, but he was talking about the five horsemen currently obviously galloping around the world. You know, we've got huge geostrategic tension. We've got the climate crisis. We've got global mistrust at an all-time high. And then we've got the dark side of digital, sort of the Facebooks of this world. And then we've got COVID. Now, I would say that global mistrust is actually predominantly being driven by two things, media and digital. So, you know, when you think about the role of technology in all of those, actually, it is phenomenally powerful if it can be harnessed for the right sort of end outcomes and the right end use. So I think AI and data is so important. And this growing movement to use data alongside investment, to use data alongside, you know, consumer purchasing, to use data alongside supply chain transparency. So really understanding where your core ingredients, your supply chain is actually coming from, the resources within that, and then the people within that as well. It's key. It's absolutely key. And I think that's why, COGEX and, colliding these worlds together to have this conversation is so critically important. The future is going to be about data, the quality of that data, and what that data enables us to do. There is a reason why Microsoft decided to partner up with BlackRock on data, specifically for the finance sector. Now, we could argue that, isn't it a shame that Microsoft didn't decide to do that with somebody else? But, the fact that Microsoft, the world's largest technology company, themselves pivoting to becoming and to wanting to be a much more purposeful company, not a responsible company, a purposeful company, responsibility being a subset of that. We can see this now starting to happen, and it's really exciting. It's really, really exciting. But we also need to be very, very mindful that with that comes the whole raft of issues around data security and privacy as well. So there is no silver bullet, unfortunately, and there is no perfect solution, because everything that we do has, unfortunately, intended or unintended consequences. We just need to be very aware of those and manage down those negative externalities as much as we can. Troy, you're nodding again.
Yeah. So fantastic points. I think one thing I would add is, from a financial sector perspective, they're also in a perfect position to create incentives to drive that appropriate behavior. So as we get more clarity and transparency over supply chains, and we're looking at, do I go to the dollar store to pick up, XYZ product, or do I go to this other place? I'm understanding what the repercussions are of that. And if you look at credit card schemes that drive incentive cash back, et cetera, there is an opportunity to create products that could actually, help generate an economic benefit. And if you can link that back to having a sustainable company that actually is a lower risk than banks, can effectively direct more investment to them because they're actually a lower risk, a lower likelihood that they won't get paid back, which helps their capital requirements. That means in practices, it translates down to consumer behavior to enable them to understand in a language that they fully get. Ceteris paribus, all things equal, go for this product that is more sustainably sourced or has lesser impact than this other one. And that education side is there. It's that premium that we're starting to see gradually shift. We've seen it with things like Fair Trade and other labels. It's a slow and gradual process, but we need to speed up that incentivization process to change the consumer behavior.
Absolutely. I mean, JP, there's a couple of really interesting, well, there are loads of, there's all good questions in the Q&A, but there's a couple there that are particularly, I think, interesting, especially sort of personal hobby horses of mine, talking about data-driven investing. Do we need to move to data-driven investing? Ultimately, that's what the passive market would say that they do. It's a rules-based investing paradigm based on the data. Ultimately, yes, as the data quality improves and the data coverage improves, and machine learning is such, or AI is such, that it can understand really some of the nuances in that data, then yes, we can. My concern at the moment about sort of a purely data-driven approach to investment is that it has been hijacked a little bit by the passive industry, and that's quite lazy investing. We're seeing ESG funds that are coming through, passive ESG funds that are coming through, that are holding the very companies who we need to transition, but who are currently demonstrating no intent position. So, when you are holding somebody's values in one hand as keenly as you are holding their aspirations for financial performance, you can't do that. So there is a need at the moment, I think, for that collision between kind of data and then those who actually really understand what the data is telling them and are able, therefore, to pivot the approaches to investing to ensure that you're really focusing on the businesses that have the solutions. I mean, I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, what I thought I'd do is answer the question just before that around this common practice of sustainable behavior costing money. If you look at the behavior, and there's been several providers out there that have come back and done analysis on ESG-related funds, showing that actually there's been outperformance of those companies that are placing greater focus on these environmental, social, and governance risks and opportunities. And that's ended up driving greater shareholder value and, less volatility in terms of their share pricing compared to the broader peer market. There's also been a greater shift in terms of renewable energy, one that's much larger than all the other fossil fuel sectors. So there's increasingly that economic and that empirical argument that investing sustainably actually just makes good financial sense, as well as being something that is going to help the planet. And that's really important to populate and convince those skeptics with that economic data, with the language that they know.
I think, yeah, I was going to say, Troy, I mean, it's a really important point to make, because people often ask me, how many times do you have to defend what you do as a business? I don't. Now, when I set Tribe up and when we went out there, a lot of people were, oh, well, you know, ESG investing. And let's be clear, we don't do ESG investing. We go way beyond ESG based investing in what it is that we do. But there was still that sense of it, you're going to compromise financial performance as a result of adopting this kind of investment paradigm. I now just draw people to our website and the performance that we have on the website, the performance papers that we have on the website. And I'm saying, if after reading those, you have any questions, by all means, I'm happy to sit down and explain to you how we have outperformed the benchmarks. Because to Troy's point, these are resilient businesses. These are the businesses that have been able to ride the downturn in the markets as a result of COVID far better than their sort of non-resilient, you know, counterparts, those who haven't really externalized or begun to externalize the true costs of running a business. And, you know, there's more than enough data in the marketplace now to show that this type of investing is resilient on up and down cycles, which is why we're seeing these huge flows into ESG. And as I said, you know, ESG is a subset of impact investing, but as a bellwether for market sentiment, it's phenomenal, because we can now see that everybody's looking for safe harbors, and the safe harbors are the businesses that have this built-in resilience. And to Troy's point, these are the ones who are managing the risks and the opportunities better than those who aren't. So we're starting to see some seismic shifts, I think, out in the marketplace. And there almost is now no room for the discussion of, you know, impact-driven investment means you compromise financial performance. You know what? In some instances, you might, depending on the nature of the deal. But at a portfolio level, I think there's enough evidence out there to say, far from it. In fact, completely the opposite.
You know, that's a great point. Every investment involves risk, and that's really important. But like, consider that if you've got greater visibility over the impact that you're having, and this is where it goes down to investor behavior of, if we gain 100 pounds in our portfolio, there's a certain amount of happiness we have in it. If we lose 100 pounds, we feel that commensurately more, because even though they're the same loss, in even on an unrealized basis, what impact investing and reporting on that can do is, during that transition where we might be down 100, if you know that actually your capital is being good for these other achievements, what that does is sort of say, well, I understand that there's some volatility right now, but I know in the meantime, I'm actually investing in something larger. And what you see is, over the longer term, it starts to come back in the financial returns, and you also get the impact, which is great for feeling good about it, but also that legacy point. Just quickly on a question around the global change is happening, but is it quick enough? Like, probably not. I think the incentivization of capital on COVID-19 and getting that toward greener strategies is going to be a real opportunity. And so we need to like ramp that up globally, which is going to mean we all have to transition and learn more quickly about it. But we have to recognize that we're in a country that...
Yeah. Last question related to that is, you know, how do we fund, you know, initiatives that can help us, you know, accelerate, in the case, in the context of the event today, you know, they talk about funding these moonshot climate initiatives, right? But, you know, within our sector and our businesses, what do we need to do to accelerate, to make something happen that is completely new and different? Because I made the point before that things take time.
Right. Okay.
That would be the last point. And then after that, we'll make a final comment and we can finish.
Every one of us has a pension, pretty much. If you want to like start to make an impact, and it's been echoed before, ask your pension provider how sustainable your portfolio is invested. Ask at your level so that you start getting the shift towards a portfolio that actually is directing investments to things that are not causing further degradation, but are actually helping the planet. The more you ask, the more the demand for that product is going to be there. And, you know, that eventually has a huge impact on taking huge amounts of capital and shifting it in the right direction.
Thank you.
Yeah, so to riff off from Troy, go and check out the Make My Money Matter campaign in the UK. definitely go check out Make My Money Matter. Also, you can go to places like Client Earth as well, the mighty Client Earth. You have some great tools on the website for you to ask those types of questions as well. I mean, JP, I question whether or not we're getting a little bit preoccupied and obsessed with moonshots. A lot of the solutions that are required, we already have. Okay. We have them, okay? What we need to do is to get the capital to them, and we need to get them at scale, deployed at scale very, very quickly. This is where I think, and I will a little bit of boom right at the end. Tax. We have to fundamentally interrogate the global tax infrastructure that is put in place, both for personal wealth and for corporate wealth. You know, there's a growing call in the UK, for example, for us to have our own sovereign investment fund that potentially is powered by, for example, the tech tax and other forms of fairer, more equitable taxation that goes into a sovereign fund that powers the investments into UK-based solutions and UK-based, you know, interventions that not only have an impact in the UK, but potentially more globally or more regionally. And that becomes almost a people's fund. It's a fund to tackle the issues that we as a community face. A lot of this sometimes I think gets, you know, we tend to kind of get very, very excited by moonshots. Let's go moonshots, you know, let's go over here. A lot of the solutions we already have, okay, we need to really focus on what they are and get the capital moving there. And tax is it's not the only tool we have, but it is a massive tool that really now needs to be investigated. You know, the time for the global conversation on tax has come. We need it.
Agree. Hear. Thank you so much. I'm going to be closing with a final a statement or remark or thought. So I would like to close by saying that I'm still, aside from everything, you know, very optimistic. You know, history shows that we can come together to solve the biggest of challenges. You know, I have faith on that. However, if we look back at the financial crisis of 2008, we had one of the biggest challenges yet until perhaps now with COVID. It was a big liquidity challenge, to say the least. And as Tim Geithner said one time, at least in relation to the US, so financial resources large enough to do anything. But on this occasion, I think financial resources will not be enough, and we will not have time to react and fix things. So we must be proactive. Thank you. And I hope you enjoyed the discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILEAN Partners and Fast Forward 2030. Please connect with us at ILEAN Partners for advice on how to transition into sustainable and impact investing. And go to fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models.